All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, Veterans Radio, the voice of America's veterans. We're very excited to have you on our program today. As I mentioned, my name is Dale Thronberry. I was an Army aviator helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. We want to welcome you to today's program. We're really excited. We're going to be talking with an author of a book entitled 40 Thieves on Saipan. It's a kind of an autobiographical story written by the son about his father's experiences on Saipan. And they were it's kind of a secret organization within the Marine Corps. And so we're going to be talking with Joe Tukovsky, a little bit later on in the program. But first, I want to make sure that we thank our sponsors, and that would be starting off with Legal Help for Veterans, specializing in veterans' disability claims. For more information, you can go to their website, that's legalhelpforveterans.com, or give them a call at 800-693-4800. We also want to thank the National Veterans Business Development Council, or NVBDC. Their purpose is to certify that a veteran-owned business is actually really veteran-owned. And they also put on a number of seminars to help veterans expand their businesses as they go along. So listen, if you want more information about NVBDC, give them a call at 888-237-8434. 888-237-8434. It's really important for veteran-owned companies that they are certified if they want to do business with the federal government and with veteran-friendly corporations. We also want to thank the Eisenhower Center here in Ann Arbor. The Eisenhower Center provides treatment for post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injuries, and so forth. They've got a great program here locally called After the Impact. And it is something that we've talked about. I think it was even just last week we did this. The Eisenhower Center cares for athletes, veterans, and first responders while they work through intense treatment program. After the Impact addresses education and care for individuals with health and behavioral issues from post-concussion syndrome, post-traumatic stress, TBI, and other similar diagnoses. It's an in-house program. And so for more information, you can contact them at theeisenhowercenter.com. I think they've got two programs going. They've got one here in Michigan and also one in Florida. And finally, we want to thank one of our local organizations. Well, it's actually not that local, but it's part of the VBOC program, and that is the Veterans Business Outreach Center. In Michigan, it is called VetBiz Central, and VetBiz Central handles the VBOC program in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, and it's an organization of veterans helping veterans, especially veterans trying to get their businesses off the ground. It's a great resource for veterans who are trying to start a business, trying to grow their business, and so forth. They've got all sorts of entrepreneurial training, education, mentoring, and everything else. For more information, you can go to VetBizCentral.com. VetBizCentral.org, excuse me. And all that information is there. And it's just a great program, especially for veterans that are trying to get their businesses off the ground. I think it's something that is really important to all of us out there. I need to talk a little bit right now about a pretty serious topic. And as many of you may know, September is Suicide Prevention Month. And of course, with our audience, we're very, very concerned about veteran suicide. The numbers have dropped a little bit over the number of years. It's not exactly up to 22 again, but it is still pretty high. And in fact, for those of you that are not aware of it, where's my number go here? So there are only 20 million veterans left in America these days. When we first started doing Veterans Radio back in 2003, there were over 25 million. And so, as you can tell, the World War II generation is passing away rapidly, unfortunately, and now we're getting into the Korean veterans, and the Vietnam veterans themselves are getting a little bit older as we speak. But the average right now, according to the VA, the Veterans Administration, is a little over 17 veterans a day are committing suicide. And that's 1.5 times the national average for males that are committing suicide. And the number for female veterans is it's 2.5 times the number of women committing suicide. So these numbers are astronomical, and we're trying to figure out a way that we can raise awareness of the veteran suicide out there. And I want to make sure that for any of you out there, anybody that you know is contemplating hurting themselves, to contact the Veterans Crisis Line. And that number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Press the number 1 and you'll be talking to a live counselor right away. Don't hesitate. If you know of somebody that you think is having suffering, call. Get them help. Get them the help that they need. It's out there everywhere for them. We just need to make sure that we can get them to do that. But one of the ways that we're here locally trying to remind people that it is a National Suicide Prevention Month is with a display of, well, I'll let John talk about it. Out at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial here in Ypsilanti, Michigan, the Vietnam Veterans of America Post 310, Charles S. Kettle's post, has been putting as a display up, heightening what I was just talking about. So joining me on the line from VVA 310 is their current secretary. That's John Luker. And John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you, John, for taking time out to talk about this. This is I really wanted to highlight what you guys and women are doing out there. So could you tell us what you're doing out at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial?
We have a location right near South Huron River Drive, where we are putting up 22 crosses every day at 10 o'clock in the morning. We have enough room out there so that every day you drive by that location, you'll see additional crosses. The hope is that as you see how those crosses are relentlessly growing, it'll remind you of how many people, 660 people in a month, really is, how serious that suicide problem is.
Absolutely, John. It's such an emotional thing for people to see. We're talking about this display that is out in Ypsilanti, Michigan. It's off Huron River Drive, just off of Whitaker. I think it's Whitaker Road, out by the Ypsilanti Township offices out there, and I went out there before you set it up, and there we have this really nice, you know, beautiful memorial with a big field around it. And now you guys have gotten this a big poster out there, and 22 crosses a day are being put up in this display. And I really encourage people to go out and look at that. And you say, what time of the day do you put that day's total in?
10 o'clock in the morning.
And I understand that you are looking – you're not looking – you're looking for volunteers that could help with pounding them in. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's a two-way kind of an issue, though. Some people really need the opportunity to put in the crosses to kind of drive home their own grief for somebody they know who's already passed. And it's kind of a way for them to say, I'm not going to let that go unnoticed.
Right.
But also, it is a very emotionally difficult thing to think about a life every time you put the cross in the ground, 22 of them. So in order to keep the stress from being placed on the shoulders of two or three people, we're giving the population an opportunity to help us out with this demonstration so that nobody has to bear the burden all by themselves.
And how would they go about volunteering, John?
There is a sign-up genius going around. There's a link for that that's available at the VVA310.org website. Or you can just search for the Veteran Suicide Demonstration Project on the Sign Up Genius website. And that shows you where there are still slots available that you can sign up, and it gives you a little bit more information about what actually is involved.
Right, but I don't think you wouldn't turn anybody away that showed up at 10 o'clock just to see what was going on, would you?
Absolutely not.
I think what you're doing is such an important public service announcement, for any, you know, lack of a better definition, to show people that, you know, when you've got over 20 veterans committing suicide on a daily basis, and then you add that to the civilian population, we really have to be aware of what is going on out there. And I can't imagine that the numbers during this whole COVID-19 pandemic have not gone up. I don't know if dramatically, but I'm sure that they have gone up. And so we want to make sure that people are aware of what's going on out there at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial off of Huron River Drive in Ypsilanti Township. Go out there and look at it. It's very, very emotional scene. And, you know, go out today and check it out, and go out in another week and just see how these crosses keep growing and growing and growing. And the numbers speak for themselves. And it's older veterans right now that are committing suicide more than the younger ones. So we have to be really aware of all of you out there who have a veteran in your house or know of a veteran in your neighborhood. Check in on them every once in a while and see how they're doing. John, I want to thank you very much for what you're doing, and Al and the rest of the VVA 310 men and women who are helping you out.
Yes, it's definitely a team effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John, for taking time out to talk to us a little bit today. All right. So everybody out there that's listening right now, make sure that you find out as much as you can about suicide prevention, because there may be somebody in your family that's hurting and they don't know what to do. And so maybe you can point them in the right direction. I want to remind people of the number for the Veterans Crisis Hotline. That is, again, is 800-273-8255, and press 1 and you'll be talking to a counselor immediately. You can also text them for information, and that text number is 838-255. And if you're asking for help, people will be there to help you. All right. I forgot to thank the other people that are helping us out here on Veterans Radio, so I want to make sure that we get that there. Of course, VVA 310, Charles S. Kettles Post of Ann Arbor, VFW Post 423, also of Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Post number 46, all of Ann Arbor, Michigan, have thrown in a little bit of financial support for Veterans Radio. I remind you out there, our listeners, that Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio America. And Veterans Radio America is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. And any donations are greatly appreciated. And you can go to our website, veteransradio.net, and click on donate. And we'd be happy to accept anything that you can help us out with. It keeps us going. We've been doing this for 17 years, and we're hoping to do it for another 17. So we're going to take a real quick break right now. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Joseph Tarkovsky and his book, 40 Thieves on Saipan, the elite Marine scout snipers in one of World War II's bloodiest battles. This is a heart-wrenching story. It's an amazing story, and I want you to stick around and listen when we talk to Joe about the story about his dad and his dad's friends and colleagues and with the camaraderie of the people in the military. This book talks all about that. So you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be right back.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at vetbizcentral.org or call 810-767-VETS.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
All right, and welcome back to Veterans Radio. That, of course, is a Marine song. I'm not a Marine, but everything we're going to be talking about today is Marines. And so I'm really excited to talk and to you about our book, The 40 Thieves of Saipan. And I want to introduce our guest today, and that is Joseph Tarkovsky. He and Cynthia Crack have written a book entitled 40 Thieves on Saipan. And it's, as I mentioned earlier, it's just a gut-wrenching, emotional roller coaster of camaraderie and love among men and the losses of men and their families and everything else. And it's just a great story. And so I'm really excited and happy to welcome Joseph Tarkovsky to Veterans Radio. So, Joe, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for the opportunity today.
Well, I'm really excited to talk to you about this story, and so I'm going to get right into it. So what made you decide to write this book?
It was a eulogy delivered at my father's funeral that prompted the whole beginning of this. It was common knowledge that he'd been a Marine. He was a retired colonel, and, you know, every once in a while, place names would come up like Guadalcanal or Tarawa or Saipan, but, you know, since he never talked about it, he could have just as been easily saying to me Los Angeles or Chicago. Mm-hmm. They were just places. But the eulogy that was delivered at his funeral was about this young ROTC kid from Sturgeon Bay who went to ROTC meetings, and there was a surly sergeant there who was a Marine sergeant. And that sergeant told him this fascinating story about my father. It was that eulogy that prompted me to open my dad's footlocker and, you know, find a treasure trove of platoon rosters, photographs, awards, just almost like a Christmas gift going through that footlocker.
I should point out to our audience that your father, Frank, passed away, what, 2011? It wasn't that long ago.
No, 2011, correct.
2011, and this isn't the first time that we've had the opportunity to talk to a child of a, you know, World War II veteran who has uncovered the, you know, the secret treasure chest that was in the basement or in the garage and you know, came up with these amazing stories. Tell me about you said, I'm reading off of the information that was sent to me, is that your father passed away at 96 years old.
Correct.
And I was thinking about that the other day. My father was in the Coast Guard during World War II, and he was on Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and he would have been 116 a couple of days ago. Unfortunately, we are losing the World War II veterans, and they're not going to be around that much longer. But tell me this story about Frank and how he got into the military and about this special unit that he was involved with.
Sure. He was actually on his way to UCLA for a football scholarship back in 1937, but due to the difficulties of travel back in those days, the bus broke down somewhere and he arrived a week late. So he couldn't be on the team and he couldn't go to school and, you know, have the scholarship to go to school. So a migrant worked up and down the coast. And he finally found himself in San Francisco and penniless, and the Marine Corps was offering a $10 enlistment bonus. So he decided to enlist and he kept $5 for and sent $5 back to his mother.
It seems like so many men had stories like that one. So, all right. So he joins the Marines, and you know, we all know that once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine.
That's true. Yeah, that even goes for, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but part of the story is one of his platoon squad leaders has two Army friends in Hawaii, and the 6th Marine Regiment makes in Honolulu before they head off for Saipan. And this squad leader, whose name is Don Evans, finds his two Army buddies at Schofield Barracks, and they start drinking the night away, and eventually he convinces them to go AWOL and join the Marines to head off for Saipan, and they become part of the platoon.
I thought that was a great part of the story. He kind of hijacked these Army guys, because I guess the Army wasn't, you know, I don't know what the term would be, not as exciting for them. And, you know, just said, come on, we'll just took off all their Army insignias and, you know, snuck them on board the ship.
Yeah, that was a story that came directly from the platoon sergeant, whose name was Bill Knuppel, was from Morris, Minnesota. And Bill was just someone that I knew while Dad was alive as an old Marine buddy. And I would see him frequently when my dad would winter in Arizona, and that's where Bill wintered as well. And he'd always hang out, and we'd be together. And it was so funny, it didn't struck me until later on after I started doing research into the project and after Bill had passed away in 2013, was that every time Bill would bring up talking about the war, like Don Evans, that squad leader, or somebody else, all my dad had to say was, Bill, those days are over, and he would tacitly comply. And it just realized me that even at 80, 90 years old, they still had this unspoken relationship of sergeant and lieutenant.
Right. Yes, you always know who your CO is. And all right, well, we did skip ahead a little bit there. Let's come back. We are talking with Joseph Tarkovsky here, who wrote 40 Thieves on Saipan, a story of the Special Marine Scout Sniper unit that was developed, sounded like especially for this mission. Tell us how that occurred with the Marine Corps, because most of Marine Corps guys are all dog faces, you know, they're infantry. Everybody in Marine carries a rifle. So that's their main task. How did this one start out so special?
Well, there were only two such scout sniper platoons deployed in the Pacific during World War II. One was for Tarawa, and that was just a three-day, siege and very rapid battle. Saipan, however, was almost a month-long grinder and was going to be different than any other battle that they had fought in the Pacific to date, in that there was going to be a civilian population and a much larger area that needed to be conquered. And the Scout Sniper Platoon was trained exclusively to live and work behind enemy lines for days and weeks at a time. They learned how to read maps, make maps, draw maps from memory, and locate enemy positions of either, infantry or munitions or whatever. And then working behind enemy lines, as they were going to do, where firing a weapon would be their last resort, they learned build were death techniques, how to kill people silently. And he said that they learned how to kill people in ways that you can't even imagine.
And this is kind of interesting, and from the standpoint of most of us think that American military and so forth have always kind of played by the rules. And this particular secret unit was designed to play with no rules?
Well, there were no rules in the Pacific Theater. Japan never signed the Geneva Protocol, which was the precursor to the Geneva Convention. Mm-hmm. And they did not recognize any of that. So it was a pretty, and they didn't surrender. They were, fantastic warriors. The Marines both loathed and respected them. And it was a grueling, dirty, up-close and personal battle that haunted these young boys pretty much for the rest of their lives.
It sounded like that. How did your father be chosen to lead this group?
I guess he was the pick of the litter of the 6th Marine Regiment as far as lieutenants are concerned. He had been on Guadalcanal, and he won a Silver Star on Tarawa for single-handedly cleaning out a pillbox. And the single-handedness was a little inadvertent. He was leading a squad of his men up to the top of this big pillbox, 2 stories high, as he said. And he was crawling so intently, he didn't notice that the Japanese in the pillbox were throwing grenades at them. And they all went over his head, and he didn't notice them, and all of his men scattered behind him and went back down. And he finally made it to the top, and he looked around, and he was just there by himself. And at that moment, a Japanese popped out of the trap door on top of the pillbox, and he was able to kill him and throw some grenades down inside and, eliminate the threat that way. But, my father never thought he was deserving of any award of valor. He said that he didn't do anything that any other Marine wouldn't have done. And, I think that's kind of true. That, as Nimitz said of Marines in the Pacific, uncommon valor was a common virtue.
Right. Absolutely. And in reading the book, we're talking with Joseph Tarkovsky. His book is 40 Thieves on Saipan, story of the elite Marine scout snipers in one of World War II's bloodiest battles. And it really was. I strongly encourage any of you out there that are really historians and really want to know more about what really happened in the Pacific. It's a whole different war scenario than it was in Europe. It takes your breath away. All right. So your father comes in with this reputation already, and he's not assigned people. He gets the option of choosing his 40 people for his platoon, correct?
Correct. It was a very unique circumstance. A lot of times when men are in a platoon and in a squad, they stick together from boot camp through when they get out of the corps. But this being a novel platoon and the nature of the job was going to be so more perilous than just a normal Marine, that he solicited volunteers. And over 100 men volunteered for the platoon.
Well, he picked his sergeant right away, didn't he, his first sergeant?
Correct. That was Bill Knuppel, his platoon sergeant. They'd known each other since Iceland. The Marines were the first military units to be deployed during World War II. The Marines being all volunteer, it didn't need congressional approval. And finally, Roosevelt succumbed to Winston Churchill's pleas for help in their war against Germany. And he sent Marines to Iceland to replace the British troops that were stationed there. They were the same troops that got driven off of Dunkirk because they were needed back home for the anticipated German cross-channel invasion.
Right, right. It's so interesting to actually hear these stories of history as it actually happened, and this is what this book is doing. Again, if you read it, you actually feel like you're right in the middle of the whole story, which is I want to congratulate you and your co-author on putting us in there to the sense of I think my heartbeat and blood pressure all went up in a couple of these chapters that you have in there.
Well, thank
all right,
you.
So he's assigned.
Real tribute to the men that were the survivors of the platoon whom I've interviewed, because we tried to use their words as much as we could, because how they told their stories was much more interesting than anything that we could fabricate. And luckily, there were four men still alive from the platoon that I spent 8-9 years just going from coast to coast interviewing them, because what they could remember was what they could remember. But if I were to give them a little something that, you know, Bob Smuts in Georgia remembered, I might tell to Marvin Strombo in Montana, he might remember more, and then add something that Roscoe Mullins in West Virginia would, you know, add to, and then Bill Knuppel would pipe in. And it just eventually became this big jigsaw puzzle of stories that I just felt compelled to put together.
I just think that it's just great. All right, so tell us, so we have our 40 volunteers that your father approved on. But, you know, I should tell our audience that he wasn't called, Lieutenant Frank Tarkovsky. He was just called Ski, right?
Correct. It was sort of a term of an endearment, because one of the things that I read quite frequently in my dad's evaluations they would do, and also in articles that were written, is that his men liked him a lot. And I think that was because my dad was a Mustang, which is means you rose up through the ranks from a buck private. So he knew what it was like to be a private, a PFC and a corporal and a sergeant. And he didn't act like the other green, you know, lieutenants just out of school. And I think that's something that his men appreciated.
Yeah, you know, it certainly appeared that way. All right, so we've got our 40 now. Why were they called the thieves? Why weren't they just called a platoon or squad or something?
Well, their official name was the Scout Sniper Platoon, but Marines in general during World War II were notorious thieves. They were the most poorest equipped branch of service. In fact, going into Guadalcanal, the Marines were issued rations, weapons, and uniforms that were left over from World War I.
Oh, my.
Had to take on the seasoned Imperial Army, who had been fighting for almost 10 years. And they had to do it with World War I. So to increase their odds of victory, you know, as they moved forward, they felt compelled to steal from the better supplied Army and Navy. And so Marines in general were prolific thieves, but evidently my father's unit was the cream of the crop where that was concerned.
There was a story in there. What I think it was, while they're doing their training, now their training was on, was very intense, wasn't it?
Correct. They rarely had a day off. I think once they got a 3-day leave, but even on days off, they were training. Dad felt that, you know, he couldn't be as tough as the Japanese, so he rode his men hard, but they were up to the task.
And as you mentioned earlier on, they were learning these skills of survival and silent killing. And everything that they had not necessarily learned going through their basic training and experiences. And there was the episode I was thinking about was when they borrowed a Jeep from somebody. Could you relate that to our audience?
Sure. Well, first of all, Bill Knuppel always said that a guy in his H company on Tarawa was an author, that he wrote a book. And I thought, all right, you know, somebody wrote a book, like I wrote a book. But it happened to be Leon Uris. And Leon Uris's first book was Battle Cry, which is his fictionalized version of the 6th Marine Regiment. So Colonel Murray was known as High Pockets, and everybody, even General Holland Smith, had a different name. Nimitz had a different name. And in the book, he recounts this famous group of thieves within the 6th Marine Regiment. And I think they might have been known as the Foxes in the book. I'm not sure on that. And in one of the episodes that they cavort on is that they stole an Army colonel's Jeep. And so I'm really excited. At first I thought it was fiction, but then as I thought of it more, I wonder if they actually did this. So I went to each of the guys and said, did you guys ever steal an Army colonel's Jeep? And everyone kind of said no. And finally I went to Bob Smuts in Georgia, and I said to him, did you guys ever steal an Army colonel's Jeep? And he said no. And at that point, I was deflated because I thought, that's it. You know, it was just made up. Smuts said, it was an Army captain's Jeep, and we beat the hell out of that thing.
You got to get your facts straight, right?
So, right.
You can't we didn't take it from a colonel. No, we wouldn't get in any trouble for that one.
No. But it's so funny. No one wanted to rat the guy out who actually did it until I got Marvin Strombo to confess that it was a fellow named Walter Borowski who actually stole the Jeep.
We also have to remember, it's so hard for so many people to realize that these were young men in, 19, 20, maybe 21 years old in most cases.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, 18, 19. And Bob Smuts said that was the preference of the Marine Corps. They wanted kids who were 18, 19 years old because, as he put it, we just didn't have any sense. We'd go anywhere we were told. We would do anything we told. We were told. We thought we were invincible. I think that's no different for any 18, 19-year-old kid today. You just have this sense of invincibility about you.
Well, I can remember that myself 50 years ago. Go do that. Okay, no problem. Also, the type of Marines that they wanted for this elite platoon was they didn't want necessarily the best in the class. They wanted the fighters and the scrappers, didn't they?
Well, they were the best in the class in that regard.
Yeah.
Because, Bill Knuppel said that when they were going, got the record books of all the volunteers, that Dad was adamant about not interviewing them right away. And Bill Knuppel said, why? I just want to look through their record books and see if they've been thrown in the brig. And he goes, why do you want to do that? And he goes, well, I want to see if they've been thrown in the brig for, brawling. If they've been, drunk and brawling. That means they've been in a tight spot and they knew how to take care of themselves. The guy that wins the fight goes to the brig. The other guy goes to the infirmary. The guy in the brig is the kind of guy we want.
Right. And on that note, I'm going to hold off for you for a second. We're going to take a little break here. And so I remind everybody that we're talking with Joe Tchaikovsky here. His book is 40 Thieves on Saipan. It's a story of his father's elite Marine unit of Marine Scout snipers. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this invasion of Saipan and some of the horrific things that this unit went through. So you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Private Dale Hansen killed 12 Japanese soldiers in a one-man attack on their positions. Details after this.
They came from every corner of the country, from small towns and big cities. But they all shared one thing in common. They belonged to a family called Marines. A tough and determined few, dedicated to protecting everything we hold sacred. And still, they come. Celebrate the history of those proud few who have earned the title Marine.
Hansen unhesitatingly took the initiative during a critical stage of the action and, armed with a rocket launcher, crawled to an exposed position where he attacked and destroyed a strategically located hostile pillbox. With his weapon subsequently destroyed by enemy fire, he seized a rifle and continued his one-man assault. Reaching the crest of a ridge, he opened fire on 6 Japanese and killed 4 before his rifle jammed. Attacked by the 2 remaining Japanese, he beat them off with the butt of his rifle and then climbed back to cover. Returning with another weapon, and supply of grenades, he fearlessly advanced and destroyed a strong mortar position and annihilated 8 more of the enemy.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking today with Joseph Tarkovsky. He's the author of a book, 40 Thieves on Saipan, actually the story of his father's unit on Saipan. His father was Frank Tarkovsky, and he was better known as Ski. And we were just talking about this super secret special organization that is now going to be arriving on the island of Saipan. So Joe, tell us a little bit about what their mission was once they arrived on the island.
Sure. Their mission was twofold. One was to be bodyguards for the 6th Marine Regiment's colonel, James Risley. Half the platoon would do that, and then the other half would work out beyond enemy lines, searching enemy installations, mapping them, wreaking whatever havoc they could, and then they would rotate in and out.
And they did that for the first couple of days. let me back up here a little bit with a little bit of the history of why Saipan was so important to them. Well, why was that?
Well, it was a very bold move in the war in the Pacific. It was far ahead of any other Allied installation, and it was the first link in the chain of Japanese home islands. So it was very bold in that regard. It also had a civilian population, which was uncharacteristic to any battle that they had fought to date. But more importantly than that, it would sever Japanese lines of communication between the homeland and its bases farther, west. And also, two of the finest airfields in the Pacific were on those islands, airfields that were long enough to accommodate the B-29 super fortresses. And they were Oslito Airfield on Saipan and the Ushi Airdrome on Tinian. And it was the Ushi Airdrome where the Enola Gay took off of back in August of 1945.
Right. I want to make sure our audience understood how important it was. I mean, we're starting to really island hop up toward Japan and why this battle was so important. Right. So, and of course, the battle, battles never go exactly the way that they are planned. And, kind of go to plan B, plan C, whatever else is going on there. Eventually, your father and the rest of his thieves are sent out to wreak havoc and find out the information that is necessary, correct?
Correct. For the first couple of days, they were just trying to establish a beachhead because it was very precarious after, landing, like Tarawa. Japanese played possum until all of the troops had massed on the beach, or the majority of the troops had massed on the beach, and then opened fire, and the casualties were over 30% for D-Day, with a lot of commanding officers being injured as well. So it was quite tenuous for the first couple of days until they actually gained a foothold and could then have actually a front line that the 40 Thieves could work behind.
I'm looking at the list of all of the members of the platoon, which is on the cover of the book. And, initially there weren't very many casualties, were there?
No, they had led a charmed life until June 22nd of 1944. And there was an actually a reporter in camp interviewing them on the evening of June 21st, when his name was Vic Coleman. And he was talking to Don Evans. And Don Evans was quoted as saying something like, "We've got the finest fighting unit on Earth, but Marines aren't supermen. We've been lucky so far, all of us, but tomorrow we may not be so lucky." Mm-hmm. And the following day, a squad from the platoon was pretty much decimated.
And this is, I can't remember now. Was Evans one of the ones that was killed that day?
Correct.
Okay. And was he the one that recruited the two Army guys?
One of the two Army guys was also killed. And then a fellow from Heartland, Wisconsin, near Milwaukee, Philip Johnson, was also killed. And three other fellows were injured. And two were, like, the fellow who was on point that day and the one bringing up the rear, both of them looked and saw the whole squad go down. Mm-hmm. And they assumed everyone had died because the machine guns just kept on firing, as Bob Smott said, turning the bodies into nothing but bloody rags. And they jumped down a 15-foot gully, not knowing the other one had done the same thing. Both of them thought their whole squad had been wiped out when they jumped down.
And these are the things that haunted these men even after the war, of course, because, you know, when you witness these horrific battles, you know, and the battles are over in seconds, and, you know, people are either dead or they're pretending that they're dead, or they're, you know, or they're wounded, you know, horrifically. And as you pointed out, one of the things I wanted to mention, Joe, was how you developed the characters in the book. You felt like you knew every single member of the platoon. I wanted to congratulate you on that. You know, especially some of the ones that did not survive the battles on Saipan. But you were able to develop their characters, and I can't remember his name now. I think it was a Dyer, I think, who had the premonition that this was not going to end well for him.
Correct. You know, they lived together and they knew each other better than their own brothers. And through interviewing the five men and getting all of their stories, it wasn't a one-time deal. I'd see these guys maybe 3-4 times a year for the 9 years while I was researching the book. And they all became like second fathers to me. And not only the stories that they would tell, they'd give me diaries. And the Evans family gave me letters he'd written home. All they're talking about these guys. And then you get a little bit of, you know, things were very homegrown at that time. You know, people very rarely would go 10 miles from where they grew up and were born by the time these boys, you know, enlisted. That was just very uncommon for anyone to travel at all, any great distance. So, you know, to know what an Okie was and listen to some old radio is what I actually did to get an idea of the how people talked in the 40s, old-time radio like the CBS Murder Mystery Hour or Suspense or, you know, shows like that, to listen to how they talked and then adapt it into something that was understandable today, because slang back then wouldn't be, you know, recognized today. So,
right, absolutely. No, we wouldn't know what they were talking about.
Right.
That's for sure. But as I mentioned, The Private Dyer, who was, had a bad, you know, bad premonition that he was not going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And then, unfortunately, he did not.
Yeah, that was Marvin Strombo story. Marvin is Missoula, Montana. He just passed away in June of this year. And I went out to see him while he was dying. I got a phone call from his daughter on Tuesday saying, "Daddy's dying." And I got in my car on Wednesday and got there on Thursday and stayed 5 days. And his last words to me as I was walking out the door, and he died the next day, were "Semper Fi," and he pointed out Semper Fi, and that was quite a moment. But the Martin Dyer story was mostly Marvin Strombo, and these guys remember in dialogue too. You know, Bill Knuppel was great with that. Bob Smots was great with that. They'd all remember in dialogue. And it was Roscoe Mullins who was there on the mission the night that Dyer was killed.
It's just, wasn't it, is Marvin the same one who found the flag of family flag on a Japanese officer?
Correct. That was on a covert mission into Garapan. He acquired this flag. He had a great respect for the Japanese. As I said, most of the guys did, you know, in this unit. You know, when you go toe-to-toe with them, it's you respect your enemy, and you know your enemy. Because if you don't respect them, there's a famous line somewhere. I forget, it's irrelevant. But he knew that the flags were sacred to the Japanese, and he was just going to leave it be, but then he thought, well, somebody else is going to take it. At least if I take it, I might be able to get it back to the family. Why he developed this kinship to this dead Japanese officer is one of those surreal things that you hear veterans talk about all the time, about they hear a voice that says duck. So they duck, and then a bullet whizzes past where their head once was. Each one of these fellows has a story of where they hear that voice. And there was something in this dead Japanese captain that made Marvin want to take the flag in hopes that he could return one day.
And he did.
He did. In 2017, I went with him, and the family was so grateful. The flag is such a, it was almost like the brother came back from the dead. They feel as though the soul of the person is in that flag. And the younger brother, when we accepted the flag from Marvin, took it to his face and inhaled deeply and said, "You've taken good care of my brother."
It gives me chills even just hearing that again. We're coming up to the end of the program, unfortunately, Joe. And I would be very remiss if I did not mention Roxy.
Well,
and I want you to tell our audiences just quickly about Roxy, better known as your mom.
Right. They were newlywed. I don't even know if they went on 6 dates before they got married and got the Wasserman test to get married. And then, you know, they learned about each other more through the mail than they did in, you know, personal contact before he left for Guadalcanal, and they were gone for, separated for maybe 2 years.
I can't believe that. I know my parents went through the same thing. It's just unbelievable that you could be gone that long without seeing your wife or family.
Yeah, and mail was something where you might get it a month after it was penned. So what was really interesting is the arguments they would have.
that's true. I wanted to bring that up because I think that's such an important thread that weaves throughout your your book is the real love story of your mom and your dad, and luckily they were able to continue it after the war.
Correct. They did stay together after the war. Unlike some of the couples, many of the men from the platoon went through a litany of broken marriages, estranged children. Two of the fellows drank themselves to death by the time they were 40, and Alma Smots, Bob's wife, when I first went to visit and talked to Bob, said, "This is so great. You know, he has nobody to talk to, and this really means a lot that he can, you know, talk to you about these things." And then she confided to me that as a young bride, when they were first married, she would wake up at night to find that Bob was choking her because he was having one of his nightmares.
I think these men, the experiences that they went through, they were never able to really leave behind them as much as they tried. It's like, you know, somebody asking any veteran, you know, where were, you know, where were you last night? They were right back wherever it was, whether it was World War II or Vietnam or Korea and so forth. Unfortunately, I kind of have to wrap this up right now, Joe. The name of the book is 40 Thieves on Saipan. Where could we get this book?
Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Noble. Any local bookstore should be able to get it for you. So if you want it really fast, Amazon gets it to you in, I think, 1 or 2 days, more often than not. But otherwise, it's available everywhere.
That's great. I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio and for writing this book. And please tell your cohort, Cynthia, that you did a great job with this.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
And if you write another one, let us know. We'd be more than happy to promote it. You'll be able to find a link for the book on our website, veteransradio.net. Today's program will be up there later on this evening. So, Joseph Tarkovsky, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
All right. We're at the end of another program here, folks. I really encourage you to go out and find out more about this story. It's great. I want to remind our listeners, if you have any comments, please leave them on our website. We like that. We're also, as I mentioned earlier in the program, Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio America. We are a nonprofit organization, so your donations would be tax deductible. Woohoo, right? So next week, Jim Falzone will be back, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks with There I Was. We're going to try an online live program toward the end of September. So until then, this is Dale Thronberry. We thank you very much for listening to Veterans Radio, and until then, you are dismissed.